Listen, as Leo the lion's roar, usually unaccompanied by any other sound, is here underlined by the savage slashes of composer Bronislaw Kaper's music. Slashes because the music suddenly drops in and just as suddenly drops out, precluding any follow-through. Also notice how neurotic the music is. The slash is repeated over and over and over again, repetition being a sign of neurosis. Finally, notice how ear-dinning it is. Right at the outset, Act of Violence, this B-suspense thriller from MGM, done in the noir mode, disarms us. Disarms us with its sabotaging of Hollywood's classic style. The suspenseful introduction of one of the male leads is also disarming. The tilt down of a New York cityscape, of a trench-coated figure in a snap-brim hat in long shot, hurriedly limping into a seedy hotel in a black, rainy night, ascending the stairs with his back to us, the detail of loading a gun, and finally, and only finally, the introduction of the face of Robert Ryan, one of the movie's leading players. This ain't how leading players are brought in to a movie. That Robert Ryan is limping also unnerves us. As to the fact that we are plummeted smack dab into the middle of things, here's such a lethal thing as loading an automatic, without knowing why the character is loading the automatic, and needless to say, without knowing who the character is. But wait, there's even more unsettling things. Save for only two intertitles, we've only seen Metro Goen Mayer Presents and the name of the picture, the film abandons the rest of the opening credits, saving them until the end. Finally, there's the matter of pace. The start of this movie literally takes our breath away as we are taken from a cityscape, a hotel, a bus ride out of town, the arrival in a small town, crossing a street during a parade, booking another hotel room, eventually looking for a number in the phone directory and placing a call. And this pell-mell pace will be continued during the entire 82 minutes of the movie. B-films pack oodles of action in a short running time. This is one of the graces of B-films. This is one of the things that I like best about B-films. No fuss, no frills, no fuming, no attitude, just the heart of the matter. Hello, I'm Drew Casper, the Alma and Alfred Hitchcock Professor of American Film at the University of Southern California School of the Cinematic Arts, and the author of Postwar Hollywood, 1946 to 1962. And I am your host through this gripping, sleekly fashioned B-film, Act of Violence.
I don't know. Never mind that.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Now, notice how different the introduction is of this other male lead. Actually, his introduction is completely opposite the introduction of Robert Ryan. We cut to Heflin's face and pull back to a contextualization of that face. Van Heflin has his little son on his shoulders, is surrounded by many people, including his wife, played by Janet Leigh, at the opening ceremonies for a new housing development for which he was the contractor and for which he is being honored. Therefore, we know he is husband and father, a family man, a contractor by trade, a community leader in the small town of Santa Lisa, and an ex-vet. The MC of the ceremonies gets him on stage with the line, "On the double, Captain." And later in the next scene, his ex-veteran status is confirmed by his wife, who tells him he's about to go on a fishing weekend to take his army jacket and his army boots along. Incidentally, he will wear his military jacket on the fishing trip, which hints at his past, and which in time we will find out influences future. Now, the past of a character, that it is problemed, that it insinuates itself into a character's present, are constant motifs of the noir style. The two different ways of bringing on the two lead characters employ two opposing literary designs. In the case of the Ryan character, we know nothing about him. In the case of the Heflin character, we know a good deal about him. The two different ways of bringing on the two lead characters employ two opposing settings, the city versus the small town, the cheap hotel room versus the warm home. The two different ways of bringing the two lead characters employ two opposing lighting schemes, the low-key black night versus the high-key sunshiny day. The two different ways of bringing the two lead characters also employ two different types of staging, a man alone versus a man in a crowd, and then man with his wife. Okay, these two different ways of bringing on the two lead characters pits one character against the other. Before any verbal, before any visual confrontation between the two leads take place, the director, through his literary design and his mise-en-scene, has contrasted one character against the other, and so has enunciated the central conflict of the film. And what a director act of violence has! Fred Zinnemann, one of the most significant voices of the post-war period, who with act of violence is finishing his apprenticeship at MGM. Fred Zinnemann was born in 1907 in Vienna, son of a Jewish physician. While studying the law, he did get his degree in law in 1927, he saw three movies that were his road to Damascus: von Stroheim's Greed, King Vidor's The Big Parade, Sergei Eisenstein's Potemkin, all documents of social realism. Well, that was enough. To the Technical School of Cinematography in Paris to study for a year, he went. Then up to Berlin, he began assisting the very famous cameraman Eugene Shuften. In 1929, he co-photographed a film called People on Sunday, a blending of documentary and fiction about what Berliners do on a typical Sunday. The next year, 1930, he went to America, where the famous documentarist Robert Flaherty offered him a job as assistant on a documentary to be made in the Soviet Union. It was never realized. But 3 years later, with still photographer Paul Strand, he made a movie commissioned by the Mexican government on the revolution. It was called The Wave. It was a semi-documentary dealing with the lives of some impoverished fishermen. That film, The Wave, got him a contract at MGM to make documentary shorts from 1937 to 1939. He made 18 of them. One of them, That Mothers Might Live, in 1938, won him an Academy Award. Now, documentary. They ran one or two reelers, 10 or 20 minutes, 3-day shoot for each film, taught him how to research a movie, taught him discipline in making a movie, but especially, as evinced in this film, the need to tell a story as economically as possible. He eventually signed a contract with MGM in 1939 to direct B features. It ran for about 9 years. The last of the B features was the film that we are seeing right now, Act of Violence.
That's it, boy. Now, if you want to keep the car out another week, just send us a money order. The boss don't like checking. We'll check your mileage as soon as you...
Now, Zinnemann, grounded as he was in documentary filmmaking, naturally gravitated to this style of documentary realism in making fiction films, as in Act of Violence. You know, in the beginning of noir, which crystallized somewhere between 1940 and 1945, the noir style gravitated toward the expressionistic mode. But with the seminal film in 1945, House on 92nd Street, produced by the documentary filmmaker Louis de Rochemont for Daryl F. Zanuck at 20th Century Fox, documentary realism began to be foregrounded and allied itself with expressionism as constituents of another noir mold. From 1945, most noir films were a combination of documentary realism as well as expressionism. Some films did continue down the road that were purely expressionist, for example, like Joan Crawford in Sudden Fear, which came out of RKO in 1952. But most films after 1945 was this combination, documentary realism as well as expressionism, as we have here. The documentary realism as seen in the location shooting here in the Big Bear Lake District. Earlier, Santa Monica substitutes for Santa Lisa. Later on in the film, the Bunker Hill section of LA, where we'll have night-for-night shooting. This documentary realism mixed very easily with the expressionism in the film. We have that with the shadows, the canted angles, the foreground placing, the decentering that we will see. So now noir is a style, either pure expressionism or more usually a combination of expressionism and documentary realism that was felt in all genres, but epicentered, as here in Act of Violence, in the suspense thriller. You know, documentary realism gave Zinnemann's work an authenticity, an emotional sincerity. And this authenticity, this emotional sincerity, were also exemplified by the situation and the kind of characters and their conflicts that he gravitated to in his work. And though Act of Violence is a work during Zinnemann's apprenticeship in features, he's not a named director, and that's another characteristic of B-films, the use of no-named directors. Despite the fact that this is an apprenticeship work, it seethes with the central preoccupations of all of Zinnemann's major films that are still to come, like High Noon, or From Here to Eternity, or The Nun Story, or Man for All Seasons, or Julia. Act of Violence contains the Zinnemann imprint. And what was uppermost in Zinnemann's personal and artistic mind? It was the problem of identity, grounded and shaped in one's conscience. In Zinnemann's work, there is the focus upon a man who has lost himself because of something in the past, and so fights through this something toward a renewed selfhood. These films are concerned with a grope towards self-redefinition, as we have here with Robert Ryan's character, Joe Parkson. Joe Parkson has been betrayed, as has his comrades during the war, by his superior and friend, Frank Endley, who ratted them out during their incarceration in a Nazi prison camp. There, Frank told of their escape. The 10 comrades lost their lives and Joe became a cripple. So Joe's mission is to seek justice, to avenge the betrayal and the deaths and his own deformed condition by murdering the culprit. He has literally become unhinged from himself and from his girl because of this. He has come apart, he is split. Though he has come apart because of his obsession, he still pursues it. Will he ever rethink such a self-destructive stance and give it up? Will he ever become whole again? Will he ever redefine himself as the man he was? That is his problem and part of the movie's problem. With Joe, we have an image of man's grope, or possible non-grope, toward self-redefinition. The other side of identity that Zinnemann details in his canon concerns a man who stands to lose his sharply defined sense of himself and struggles to maintain it at enormous cost, even death. It is an image of man struggling against fragmentation. This is exemplified in the film by Van Heflin's character, Frank Endley. He is progressively being ripped apart by guilt. Yes, he betrayed his men, he betrayed his best friend, he was responsible for their deaths. Yes, he did it. Partially for, well, he felt that their scheme was foolhardy and they would die. And then later on he says, no, I did it to get gifts from the Nazis. He did it for this and that, as we all do. Probably many more reasons. But he did do it. But his subsequent life as a clean living family man, as a community leader, and an overall good and decent, honest man, has somehow compensated for this past mistake. But with Joe's arrival and pursuit, Frank's life is being questioned, is being uprooted, is being undermined, he is being ripped apart, torn to pieces, it is being taken from him. Now he must face up to that, address it, not avoid it, and resolve to do the right thing, the good thing, not something else in terms of maintaining his identity that he has rebuilt after the war. Here is an image of the struggle against fragmentation. Notice how visually eloquent Director Zinnemann is, as in this sequence when Frank, fishing trip short-circuited, returns home. We've been in this home before, earlier in the picture, but the lighting was high key then, illustrative of a happy time. Now the lighting has changed. It is low key. Shadows here and there. Marks on walls with lines and patterns cast by the outline of the props, all of which make the room look smaller. Notice also the low beam ceiling of this set, which adds further to the sense of enclosure and entrapment. At one point, Frank will take to a corner that is almost pitch black. Now, the corner is a piece of space indicative of hiding out. It is a place of safety in that two supporting walls come together. Eventually, his wife Edith turns on the light, indicative of Frank having to turn to light about his past misdeed, dredging it up, addressing it, not suppressing it, and particularly in this instance, telling her about it, not keeping her in the dark, steps necessary for preserving his identity. Frank? Notice how, in this sequence, he turned off lights, he closed curtains, he locked doors, he pulled shade down, which objectively correlates to his subjectivity. This is what he has done about the matter so far, and this is what he's still prone to do, to put some kind of obstruction between him and it, to keep it away, to keep it outside, separate it from that which is on the other side. That is why he is coming apart. That's why he is self-fragmenting. This emphasis on subjectivity, these visual analogs, you know, closing the doors, pulling down the curtains, as we're seeing, gets us inside the character more and more and more and more. It makes us feel what the character is feeling. Noir reveled in subjectivity. It's one of the major contributions of noir to Hollywood picture making, which was indicative of the, or an example of the Freudian introversion of the American fiction film in American picture making in the 40s and 50s. Not only is Zinnemann a visually eloquent director, he is orally adept too. Listen how the use of sound effects, hear the blaring of the telephone rings, not once but twice, creates suspense while startling us. Yes, this type of sound, you know, and the volume of it literally startles us. Here too, an objective correlative of Fred's subjectivity, a way to get us to feel what he is feeling. The sound of the telephone cuts through him and fragments him, so too it cuts through us. The film's use of sound effects to create suspense and to affect us viscerally by startling us, all the while a vehicle for character subjectivity, is exceptional. In addition to the phone rings, we hear the doorbell go off a couple of times, and again for another couple of times. Recall what I said about the connection between repetition and neurosis. We hear off-screen the sound of a foot dragging itself on the area around the house. We hear the doorknob turn. And all along during this scene in the kitchen, there is that annoying sound. Is it tap water running in the sink, or is it a coffee percolating? That was quite disturbing all throughout. You know, the eloquent use of sound effects continue in the next scene, right after he goes to bed. The alarm clock ticks next to the beds of Edith and Frank. And then in the night, there is the baby scream, another sound effect, piercing the night. Now, the scream is very, very interesting because the scream of Frank's son signals a nightmare that the child is having, and in turn is an objective correlative of the nightmare that Frank is experiencing. You know, sound effects such as these, loud ones, and these sound effects have all been loud, the telephone, the doorbell, even the sound of the limping foot on the other side of the kitchen, the sound of the kitchen back door turning, the sound of either the tap water running in the sink or the coffee percolating, have all been disturbing. disturbing because they are loud and they are insistent. We hear them again and again and again. And this use of sound effects, you know, as correlatives of subjectivity continue through the film. Later on, we're going to get the sound of train and train whistles and train stop signs, or the sound of the howling wind. Zinnemann's films are about bouts of conscience, mirrors of identity crises, which was a bugaboo, especially for the post-war American male. Now, one of the countless reasons that the fragmented or splintered male at this time was the physical and psychological wounds of World War II that he had still sustained in peacetime. As such, Act of Violence is a telling social realist document of the crisis in masculinity that wreaked havoc with male identity post-war, and a subject that riddles practically every noir film. By this time, the double narrative nature of the film has kicked in, a literary strategy that further undermines classical Hollywood cinema, which usually is concerned with one protagonist. Act of Violence is concerned with two. The movie never ceases to disarm, never ceases to disturb.
I don't understand them myself. Come on, let's go on up.
Here, he starts the scene in bed with the clock ticking. She's sleeping, but he's not. And of course, what does he feel? Oh, the baby scream will tell you what he feels. The baby's screaming because the baby had a nightmare. Obviously, he's having a nightmare too. The last three scenes, before dinner, after dinner, and the middle of the sleepless night scene, show Zinnemann's care with performance. Zinnemann always felt acting was more behaving than performing. So I guess I should say that Heflin and Lee behavior is blameless. Remember, under Zinnemann's baton, Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, Julie Harris, all method actors, made their movie debuts. And Gary Cooper and Frank Sinatra and Donna Reed and Paul Scofield and Jason Robards and Vanessa Redgrave won Oscars under Zinnemann's guidance, while Audrey Hepburn and Robert Shaw and Wendy Hiller and Jane Fonda and Montgomery Clift on two occasions garnered acting nominations. Now, Act of Violence is cast with non-stars. That's another trait of B-films, the casting of non-stars. Either actors on their way up, actors apprenticing, you know, as it were, as with Van Heflin and Janet Leigh and Robert Ryan, or actors on their way down, actors past their prime, as with Mary Astor, whom you're going to meet shortly.
Look, baby, going back to bed. It's all right now. There's nothing to worry about.
Van Heflin was 39 years old when he made this film. While doing stage work, he started on the sidelines of movies in 1936. It was Katharine Hepburn who was so mesmerized by him on the stage that she demanded that he co-star with her in A Woman Rebels at RKO in 1936. That was his first film. After that, she demanded that he co-star with her in The Philadelphia Story on Broadway. Heflin signed a contract with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in the early 40s and did the company very proud by nabbing the 1942 Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor as an alcoholic intellectual in Johnny Eager, an A film directed by Mervyn LeRoy starring Robert Taylor and Lana Turner. The studio's idea was to mold Heflin into another Spencer Tracy, but alas, that never came to be. O Felix Culpa, because he is not Spencer Tracy, he is different from Spencer Tracy. This was his second outing with Zinnemann. He had made one of those B films with Zinnemann before. It was a thriller called Kid Glove Killer in 1942 about a power-hungry politician. By the 40s end, Heflin left MGM, signed with Universal for a few years, and then took the independent route and stayed in pictures till about 1972. Oh, he could act. Oh, he could act. Did Van Heflin ever give a bad performance? And because of that, I believe he was underrated and undervalued. We came to expect the very best of Heflin when we went to see him in pictures, and we were never disappointed. He gave us the very best, so we took him for granted. Because of Zinnemann, his performances, Frank and Lee, is very, very special as he goes from this very bright, man, a man so secure to his descent, his plummeting into the dark night of the soul, as we could see here.
What did it to him, the strain he went through?
Things like that happen sometimes.
Now, Heflin was a very genre-diverse actor with a range. He played many types of films, and he played good men in these films, bad men in these films, as well as ambiguous men in these films. Were they some of the reasons he never became a star? You know, the audience didn't have a distinct persona to grab onto, a distinct persona that was created by consistency and repetition. He didn't have that. Every time out, it was a different type of movie. Every time out, it was a different type of guy. Or was it the fact that he never became a star because his looks were very, very average, that he had an everyday quality to him, which incidentally Zinnemann embraced, that he looked ordinary, that he looked like one of us, well, clinched our connection with him and his plight. Heflin usually played supports in A films and leads in B films.
You don't know what made him the way he is. I do.
MGM never really knew how to make Janet Leigh into a star either. They put her in all sorts of pictures after she signed with them in 1947 for the post-Civil War love story, Romance of Rosie Ridge. Truth to tell, even when she left MGM, she did the same stuff. She went from this type of film to another type of film. She's 22 years old when she makes Act of Violence. As with Heflin, she never became a star, though she was a looker with a lovely figure and could act. Here, going from, you know, content in that first scene we see her, fear now, confusion, disillusionment, and building to a crescendo of frustration, irritation, and then disappointment. From the very beginning of the film, Robert Ryan, with the perspiring face, the eyes on fire, the taut body, and a limp, also under Fred Zinnemann's baton, turns in a striking performance. After a BA in literature, Dartmouth, class of 1931, and an undefeated intercollegiate boxing championship, heavyweight class, and after some work in a stock company in Chicago, he studied acting at Max Reinhardt's Actors Workshop in LA. In 1940, he signed a contract with Paramount, then RKO, then he freelanced while continuing with his stage work. MGM borrowed him from RKO for this role. He's about 40 when he plays Joe Parkson. He was much in demand at this time, having just garnered an Academy Award supporting actor nomination for the film at RKO, Crossfire. He pretty much duplicated the career arc of Van Heflin. Though Ryan played good, usually as somebody's buddy, he played sympathetic, relaxed, yet forceful, dependable, intelligent, he usually played ambiguous as here, but mostly bad. Played with drawn and unapproachable people, asocial people, wiry, obsessive, neurotic, at times psychopathic. There's resonances of that here in this ambiguous portrayal of Joe. Come to think of it, we have two Ryans in this movie, don't we? We have good as well as ambiguous. The backstory captured just previously by that scene in the kitchen when Van Heflin pulls the army picture of him smiling with his buddy, Joe, from the folder and the cupboard and shows his wife. That exemplifies the good Ryan, what he was, what kind of guy he was before all this awful thing has happened to him. While in the front story itself, we have this conflicted avenger, as we see here, exemplifying the ambiguous Ryan. So that backstory that's exemplified by that picture in the scrapbook represents the good Ryan, this the ambiguous Ryan. Since he doesn't have many lines in the film, and notice in this scene where he approaches the wife, Edith, not many lines, and he doesn't have many actions. Even when he makes his way from outside to inside, we don't see him, you know, and the actions that we do see him in are curtailed by the crippled leg. Ryan delivers a performance primarily through his eyes and his reaction. Even when he's playing with Janet Leigh, as here, or Van Heflin, while he doesn't play with Van Heflin really very much, they have the words, they have the action. Recall when he sat on a bus going to Santa Lisa. He never once looked out of the window. He has his eyes set, first, last, always, on his destination. So again, a performance built primarily through eyes and reaction. This is one of the few times that he has control of the lines.
He was a stool pigeon for the Nazis.
You're lying. You're crazy. He told me you were...
Inspired by an unpublished story by Collier Young, who was an ambitious assistant to Columbia studio honcho Harry Cohn, the adapter of this unpublished story, a man by the name of Robert L. Richards, turned in an extremely smart script. For one thing, the backstory of Joe and Frank, which holds the reason for Joe's murderous pursuit, is doled out piece by piece, little by little, in keeping with the technique of suspense. In the last two scenes, Frank's partial revelation to his wife went something like this. After dinner, he says, "He's a guy I knew in the army. He's not right. He was in the hospital. Everything that happened to him was my fault." Later on, in the wee hours of the morning, it's a fuller account. "My bombardier, 21 missions, 1 year in the prison camp." And now, in the scene of Joe confronting Edith, the account is fuller, coming as it does from Joe. "I'm a cripple because of him. Men dead because of him. A stool pigeon for the Nazis." Frank's life seems to be a deception, a cover-up. There's a secret in the past. Here is noir territory, deception, cover-up, secrets in the past. This incremental divulging of motivation, a surefire suspense gambit, is not the only remarkable thing about the script. The sharp irony that goes throughout the script is also remarkable. As in the arrival of Joe in the Santa Lisa town, a World War II Veterans Memorial Day celebration, and having Joe cross the street in the middle of the parade, interrupting the parade. Here, an ex-vet ignoring the parade. This is an ironic comment on post-war patriotism. Coming as it does from a vet, it's doubly ironic. Come to think of it, the movie's overriding conceit contains another irony. A hate-filled character, morose, obsessive with a limp and carrying a gun, emerging in this dark, rainy night in the city, turns out to be heroic, while the smiling family man, very honored in bright sunshine, is seemingly villainous. As the film proceeds, our allegiances shift from Joe to Frank, which is another unsettling thing about the movie. But in the shifting, we're not wholly convinced or satisfied that we should really ally ourselves with Joe. After all, he's bent on murdering another human being. But as we begin to side with him, we do so only begrudgingly, and that too unsettles us. The convention scene is riddled throughout with irony. In a hotel room jam-packed with drunk revelers, Happy Days are here again on the soundtrack, underlining the party noise, high-key lighting. And into this festivity, Edith searches for Frank to tell him of Joe's plans to murder him. On a secluded landing of the hotel's interior fire stairs, Frank gives his wife a fuller account of the backstory. "I was an informer. They were dead, and I was eating. I made a deal with the SS colonel." This account references a distinct post-war problem: the re-entry of UAC into American life, energizing the Cold War paranoid mentality. Informer. Formed in 1938, the House Un-American Activities Committee was brought into being to investigate subversive elements in all areas of American life and recommend litigation. It was put on hold for the duration of the war. It returned to service in 1945. Labor unions were the first target. In 1947, a year before the production began on this picture, UAC's main agenda item was the communist infiltration of the motion picture industry's activities in the United States. Chaired by J. Parnell Thomas and lasting 2 weeks, the probe charged 10 witnesses who refused to answer the question, "Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" and asked them if they would inform on anybody else. The showbiz inquest occupied UX activities more or less for the next 10 years. Some did inform. As such, the film details the plight of the informer, a person who makes a deal with those with whom a deal cannot be made or should not be made.
No, you don't know what happened.
What was it, Frank? Whatever you did, you must have had reasons.
You can always find reasons. Even the Nazis had reasons. I did it to save lives. That was my reason.
Did what? What did you do? Tell me what happened, Frank, please.
After we were shot down, we were sent to a prison camp. Joe, myself, some other officers. I wrote you about that.
I know.
I was the senior officer.
Again, notice the lighting change from high key in the convention room to the low key on the back stairs. You know, the shadowed areas. Look at the crisscross pattern here. He's holding on to the bars of the stairway, suggestive of the fence of a Nazi concentration camp, the chain link fence, you know. Look at the use of diagonals that create so much dynamism. And the conflict that Zinnemann is creating through lines, you know, lines going this way and that way, diagonal lines mainly. Look how horizontal lines are crossing with vertical lines creating clashes.
Stopping. The next morning, I went to the...
Frank's confession happens with his face cut in two, one side dark, one side light, indicative of the moral ambiguity of the character, the wrong of the past. I mean, we even get some of that here. The correctness of the present, and of course the fact that he is conflicted and fragmented and split. Also note the use of stairs here, a piece of set dressing that suggests transition. Stairs is neither here nor there, but somewhere in between, a no man's land really. It is suggestive of travel. As such, it is emblematic of Frank's betwixt and between state, and points to the beginning of his journey to escape Joe. Staircases will become iconic in Zinnemann's work. By that I mean he will use it again and again and again. It becomes the site of revelation that brings about a pivotal turn of events in the story, as it does here, as it does with Prue, the Montgomery Clift character, leave-taking of Alma in From Here to Eternity.
And when it was over, they didn't even shoot him. They just left him there.
Oh, Frank.
Zinnemann was blessed to have cinematographer Bruce L. Surtees along for the ride. With his lighting and photography, Surtees sets the overall mood of a scene, like the beginning of the scene at the convention. There's a definite mood about that, a definite mood here that's very, very different. And of course, Surtees, at Zinnemann's instruction, uses lighting as a vehicle for subjectivity, a way to convey the state's of soul of his characters, as here the enveloping sense of darkness that Joe must feel all along as he explains or tries to explain to his wife. Surtees was born in 1906. He was trained as a still photographer and retoucher. He moved west and he came out as an assistant cameraman at Universal in the mid-20s. And for the next 15 years, he learned from the very finest of the craftsmen, men like Greg Tolan and Joseph Ruttenberg and Hal Moore and Stanley Curtiz, until he shot his first film in 1942. His first MGM film was a year later. He stayed at the studio for 20 years, lending his expertise to all types of movies, easily mixing B films with A films, using black and white as sensitively as color, using classical ratio and the anamorphic cinemascope, and even 70 millimeter processes. He was hardworking too. In 1948 alone, he photographed a total of 5 films, including this B thriller. There were 2 A musicals in Technicolor from the Joe Pasternak unit, The Kissing Bandit with Frank Sinatra and Catherine Grayson, A Date with Judy with Jane Powell, and additionally 2 A female melodramas with star Margaret O'Brien, Big City and 10th Avenue Angel. Surtees is 2 years away from his first Academy Award for the Technicolor adventure, King Solomon's Mines. He will also take home the trophy for Vincent Minnelli's noir domestic melodrama in black and white, The Bad and the Beautiful in 1952, and also he will take the award for the Metro-colored historical spectacle, Ben-Hur, in 1959. Freelancing in 62, it was Surtees who was sought out by William Wyler for his horror film, The Collector. It was Surtees who was sought out by Mike Nichols for the black comedy, The Graduate. It was Surtees that Bogdanovich wanted, and no one else but Surtees, to do his The Last Picture Show.
Do I look that bad? I haven't seen a mirror since I got off the plane.
$7, sir. Thank you.
One of his mentors, Greg Tolan, who along with William Wyler, in their work for the independent producer Sam Goldwyn in the 30s, helped develop deep focus photography. Look here, speaking of photography in this night scene, how everything is, you know, quite murky, this relationship between Joe and his girl, and how everything now is softer and just a little fuzzy. Because what Joe is doing is kind of fuzzy, and the whole relationship is fuzzy, at least from her point of view. Anyhow, these guys, Greg Tolan and Wyler, developed this deep focus photography, foreground, medium ground, background in focus at the same time, and a shot usually held for the same time, which they believed constituted a realist image, an image more true to life, because in this type of visual structuring, long take, composition in depth, space is together and time is continuous, just as in real life. And this is the type of visual structuring that Zinnemann preferred, not only in Act of Violence, but through the rest of his career, because it contextualized people. It put them in a context, just as people are in real life.
Joe!
MGM contractee Phyllis Thaxter, as Anne Sturges, Joe's girl, is there to flesh out Joe's narrative. 28 years of age, at the time of the film's release, Thaxter signed on with MGM in 1944. In A film, she was on the periphery, as in her debut film, the war film, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. And in B, she was closer to the center, but never center, except for that noir female melodrama, Bewitched, that she made in 1945, where she played against type as a schizophrenic killer. Thaxter competently played nice, trusting, solicitous, caring, morally good sweethearts, as here, or wives. This B film was released in January 1923, 1949. The film premiered at the Lowe's Criterion on Broadway with a verbal logo, "The Manhunt No Woman Could Stop." That's not bad as far as logos go. By that I mean it's pretty accurate. Most logos are down and out lies, because we do have this situation of wife Anne trying to stop her, you know, husband Frank, while sweetheart Anne tries to stop her boyfriend Joe.
I wish it were that simple. Where is your husband, Mrs. Enley?
Variety loved the film. They thought it was strong meat for the heavy drama addicts, tellingly produced and played. The Hollywood Reporter didn't really like it because they simply thought it didn't ring true. The New Yorker, who have pretty heady people on their board, were perplexed by it. What's to be perplexed by this movie? Commonwealth commented, I love this comment, "This film gives your goose pimples a good workout." That's pretty good. Newsweek commended the film for its fine acting on the part of Heflin and Lee, and they felt that it had enough skillful direction in that it leaves little to be desired in the way of sheer suspense. Time magazine called it a realistically tight-knit study in fear and hatred and revenge. Bosley Crowther, writing in the New York Times, felt it gave consistent evidence of the smart direction of Fred Zinnemann. I love best the British Film Institute's publication Sequence, who looked at the film, and the critic for that wrote, "In some respects, this film is more conventional, but it outdistances much of the other current thrillers in the honesty, in the force, and the good craftsmanship of Zinnemann's direction, and the fine scripting of its central situations, and most of the acting is excellent." Though long take composition in depth is the preferred visual structure of the movie, director Zinnemann at climactic moments will use montage, the building of a scene in terms of short duration, of a series of shots. And here we are about to see a very, very arresting montage. Arresting in that it uses real LA locations that get seedier and seedier. Here we go. Meaner and meaner as Frank literally gets further and further away from his small town home and metaphorically gets further and further away from doing the right thing and so gets further and further away from essentially his good self. No, the sights, Bunker Hill, downtown City Hall, Angel's Flight, Clay Street, the Industrial District, are typical noir territory and set in typical noir time, night. Notice how the images are put together in a disjointed fashion. Zinnemann and his editor, Conrad A. Nervig, don't match cuts really, creating this disconnect, at once evocative of Frank's disconnect with the very best in himself. Also notice the descent into the LA netherworld, involving a series of stairs. He's always going down, down, down stairs. Again, the icon of stairs in Zinnemann's work. Notice also the constant movement of Heflin in this film. Finally, he makes his way to this very, very shoddy, tiny, sad bar in the industrial section. Also, during this montage passage that we've just seen, I hope you've listened to the arresting music by Caper that gets louder and louder. Though a B film, the full mighty MGM studio orchestra, about 60 or so members, was enlisted under the baton of the just getting started Berlin-born composer, arranger, and conductor André Previn. This is Previn early in his career. This film, along with the other B-thriller, Scene of the Crime, began his conducting chores at MGM. He's only 19 years old when he does work on this film. And down the road, he will win 4 Oscars. Gigi for MGM, Porgy and Bess, Irma LaDuce, and My Fair Lady. He was a child prodigy who joined MGM when he was only 15 years old, arranging those jazz piano features for Jose Uterbi in Joe Pasternak musicals. He, of course, will eventually wind up as conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra.
Hey, stick around. He'll give it to you. Hey, what's your hurry, handsome?
Frank's descent into the bowels of L.A. occasions his meeting up with Mary Astor, ex-silent film star, a talkie notable, possessor of an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for The Great Lie in 1941, now past her prime. She's 43 years old. And when you're 43 years old and you're a woman in Hollywood, you're past your prime, at least in 1949.
It's terrible nowadays trying to find a decent place.
I believe the materials of her own life must have contributed immensely to her lifelike portrayal of this conventional figure of a prostitute. Lifelike, no, that's too tame, that's too sedate a description. It is a performance that is literally mesmerizing. It is the best performance in the film. Here she is, a boozy, down on her luck, aging, greedy prostitute whose concern for Frank also mixes with her desire to make a buck. She really got into this part. She worked out with Zinnemann what this poor alley cat should look like and insisted firmly that the one dress she would wear in the picture would not be made by the designer of the film, Helen Rose, and it would not be made by the MGM wardrobe, but it would be found on a rack at the cheapest department store. She talks about this dress in her autobiography, and let me quote from that. We, her and Fred Zinnemann, we made the hem uneven. We put few cigarette burns and some stains on the front. I wore bracelets that rattled and jangled and stiletto-heeled slippers. I had the heels sanded off at the edges to make walking uncomfortable. I wore a fall, a long, unbecoming hairpiece that came to my shoulder. And I put on very dark nail polish. And after I put it on, I chipped it. I used no foundation makeup. Just too much lipstick and too much mascara. Both bled. That is, they smear just a little. And of course, if you take a look at Bruce Surtees' lighting for her, it's very, very unflattering. It is purposely unflattering.
Money.
Back at her flat with the exposed wiring and the wind blowing through the window, I hope you heard that, which is another objective correlative, the wind blowing through his spirit, through his soul, she mouths her philosophy. No law says you got to be happy. I'm not happy. I got my kicks. Love trouble, money trouble, all the trouble is all the trouble in the world. You either have love trouble or money trouble. Incidentally, and ironically, another irony, this alliterate irony, yes, she's so wrong. The problem for Zinnemann's people here, for Frank and Joe, and in all of his films, has nothing to do with love or money.
Is this Mr. Parkson? I'm speaking for Frank. Yeah, Enley. He says he wants to make things right with you. He says he's got a business. It's
Notice how quickly the character of this prostitute is set up by minimal action and lines. This is another glory of B-movie. Characters, major or minor in this case, are set up with such dispatch. Though A films commanded enormous energy during the post-war period, 1946 to 1962, the production of B's was stepped up. The war, remember, undermined the production of B-movies when cutbacks were the order of the day and pictures enjoyed extraordinarily long runs. Even their usual 1 to 4 weeks shooting schedule was lengthened. The 1946 consent decree's ban on block booking made this makeover inevitable. Now every picture, no distinction was made between A's and B's, had to be sold individually on its own merit and hence competitively. Now, the market for B's was still out there. Audience attrition lessened the length of a run for an A, making more available playing time on the nation's screens that B's could and did fill. Often a B film soloed in a first-run house for a week's run, as this film did at Lowe's Criterion on Broadway. And the film returned a percentage of the house rental fee in lieu of the usual flat fee that was charged for B's. And in small towns where everyone could see an A film in 3 days, the need for filler was even more accurate. A considerable percentage of patrons in urban and rural areas were also attracted to genres typical of B production, like the thriller. And B's met that double bill format that still existed in some parts of the country for the rest of the 40s and the early 50s, the Northeast notably. And it also filled the fare at the faddish drive-ins that were coming to be very, very in at this particular time. And of course, B production also kept the sound stages in Hollywood this side of desertion.
That's what he said, honest.
Bring him over.
If you can do him any good, remember it was me that brought him to you.
Go get him.
This is Mr. Gabriel, the attorney I told you about. This is Frank.
Sit down, Frank. Don't be nervous. You're in good hands. Here. I understand you got yourself in a little trouble.
No, it isn't. It was a friend of mine. It was a close friend of mine.
Sure. Now, suppose you go ahead and tell us about this friend of yours.
Tell him, Sugar. Be smart. He's a lawyer, no kidding. They got all kinds of laws. They got laws to help people, too. Go on, tell him.
Well, I was in, this friend of mine. It was during the war. It was during the last few months of...
Hiya, Johnny.
Hello.
What about the production of B films and the studio MGM? What's going on there? Well, we have to backtrack to the early 40s. A man by the name of Doré Sherry, who was a writer at MGM, approached Louis B. Mayer, who was running the studio, VP of production, for a closer relationship between A's and B's. So in 1941, Louis B. Mayer made Doré Sherry executive in charge of low-budget productions. He gave him you know, new players and players who were in their apprenticeship, craftsmen to grind out these films. Actually, it was a not just Dorie Sherry, but it was Henry Rapp, who had been around MGM for a while, who formed this unit, the Henry Rapp, Dorie Sherry unit. And Rapp was the one who looked at the budget. Sherry looked at the aesthetics of the films. Sherry at this time said, "Bee should dare. They should challenge, and they should be a testing ground for new talent." In 1943, Sherry quit, and Rapp continued with this unit. Sherry went to Selznick, first of all, and then wound up as VP of RKO, where he produced some really top noir thrillers like Crossfire and Berlin Express and They Live by Night. In 1948, the MGM president, headquartered in New York City, a man by the name of Nicholas Skenk, was aware of MGM's downward spire. 46, MGM only had $18 million profit. 47, 10.5. 48, lo and behold, 4.2. Oh my God. The lowest since the Depression. And MGM placed after Paramount and Warner Brothers and Fox in both profits and grosses. This was unheard of. So Skenk kept dogging Louis B. Mayer to get someone to fill Irving Thalberg's shoes. Thalberg was that young wunderkind who was Mayer's right hand in the early 30s, who died in 1936 at the age of 37, producing some wonderful stuff like Barons of Whipple Street and Mutiny on the Bounty and Romeo and Juliet. And it was Thalberg who got the Marx Brothers over from Paramount to MGM. Skenk thought that the administration, the way MGM was set up, you know, Louis B. Mayer surrounded by these executive producers whom people call the College of Cardinals, they were yes men, you know, wasn't working. The subtext was the fact that Mayer's taste and sensibilities were not in sync with those of post-war America. This was a time of enormous change in post-war America. So Mayer had to do something. So what he did, he brought back Dorie Sherry. And the union between this fanciful paterfamilias Louis B. Mayer, who believed in tradition and motherhood and heterosexuality, virtuous, pretty ladies, chicken soup being served in the commissary, a conservative Republican, and the feet on his ground stepson, this liberal Democrat, Dorie Sherry, did begin on a happy note. Sherry, after all, was a company man. He knew and believed and enforced the company policy of lots of production value, and even this B films had lots of production value at MGM. Star quality and a strong producer answerable to the VP of production, thus keeping in check a director's individuality. But the relationship between Dorie Sherry and Louis B. Mayer turned to armed neutrality over not how pictures were to be made, but over what kind of pictures should be made. You know, Louis B. looked to the past. Sherry wanted MGM pictures to mirror current societal trends, like, you know, for instance, the whole notion of informing, you know, that was in the air at this time because of UAC. So while they were in charge together those 4 years, 48 to 52, you know, you have, coming off the assembly line at MGM, you have Little Women, The Miniver Story, the sequel to Mrs. Miniver. You have Father of the Bride and its sequel, Father of the Little Divine, The Three Musketeers, Kim, King Solomon's Mine. You have Ivanhoe. You have those grand, grand Fried musicals like The Barclays of Broadway and Annie Get Your Gun and Easter Parade. And you have Quo Vadis. I'm going to interrupt my discussion of the B film at MGM with this visual analysis here, this other climactic moment worthy of comment here, another use of subjective sound, but a different kind, a voiceover flashback, both of the murdering thug Johnny and the flashback to the conversation between the Nazi officer and Frank, all set inside the overlit Third Street tunnel, another objective correlative, appropriate because Frank is in a tunnel situation. He is being enveloped, he's being dwarfed by his problem. Just as the tunnel envelops him as he walks. The Third Street Tunnel also suggests the escape route of his buddies, which he foiled by ratting to the Nazi officers. Next follows Frank's suicide attempt. Notice the realism of this scene in the tunnel and the suicide attempt. It's marked by the lack of process work in composition. This is all real. This is all real. And hence the truth, the immediacy comes through. You know, here, he stops by what? Cross-hatching. Here again, suggestive of the cross-hatching in the concentration camp. It's all there. Now, this attempted suicide scene is intercut between the oncoming train in wide shot and the close-up of Frank's tormented face, signaled, of course, by the sound design, that sound effect, the sound of the train before we see the train. So look, the contrast, a wide angle, long shot, the train moving, and then alternating with a medium close-up of Frank until they're both in the same shot. Okay, let me get back now to talking about the noir film at MGM. So, alongside of Mayer's work, we had Battleground, this nitty-gritty war thriller, the Stratton story, a biography of a baseball player, Monty Stratton, who lost his leg. Crisis, you know, about an American surgeon who was forced to operate on a dictator in a Central American country, and the grand one of them all, Asphalt Jungle. But the breaker was, of course, Red Badge of Courage, John Huston's second film for MGM. Mayer said no, Sherry wanted it in the worst way. And of course, Mayer went to Skenk for Skenk to make the decision. And Skenk sided with Sherry. That and the fact that Skenk decided to give the executives at MGM a raise, but that idea was put in his mind by Louis B. Mayer, and Louis B. Mayer didn't get credit for it. And that brought about the end of Louis B. Mayer's glorious reign at MGM.
There ain't gonna be any trouble.
Oh, leave him alone, Johnny. He hasn't got any dough on.
Here. Put hair on your chest.
Who are you?
Me? I'm a businessman. You and me are gonna do a little business. You got dough, friend. That's why they're all hanging around. On the chisel. Not me. I'm gonna earn it.
You get out of here.
So now we have Doris Sherry's tenure at MGM, 1951 to 1955. And while at MGM, he encourages the studio to make noir A films and energizes the B unit and the noir style from that unit. Actually, this energization of the B unit was not entirely Sherry's doing. It was a dictum from on high. It simply said, cut budgets, and that's what he did. In addition to the host of Bs coming out of MGM now in the light genres, there was a host of, you know, like musicals and comedies and ventures. There was a great deal of plethora of films, B films, coming out from MGM in the dark genres, and the dark genres inevitably used the noir style, social problem films and gangster films and police detective thrillers. It's difficult, in one sense, to distinguish A's from B's at MGM during this time, because the best produced movies in town reputation still went on while Sherry was guiding the studio between 51 and 55. The sheen and gloss still characterizes the Leo the Lion's product. And the Bees at MGM had production values, as you, I hope, have seen in this film, Act of Violence. And they come off somewhere between a B and an A. As a matter of fact, if you hold this B film up to B films at Columbia, Warner Brothers, Universal, UA at the same time, the MGM B film looks like their A films. Doris Sherry revitalized the B unit at MGM. And during his tenure, he named writer Charles Schnee to supervise seven young producers who would work the B unit. B unit doing light genres or B unit doing dark genres in the noir mode. People like Harry Berman and Saul Fielding and Sidney Franklin Jr. and Hayes Getz and William Grady Jr. and Arthur Lowe Jr. and Matthew Rapp. In addition to Matthew's father still being here, Harry Rapp, and others like Morton Fine and Albert Zugsmith.
Didn't you feel anything? Anything at all? Joe, she's just a kid. Haven't you hurt them enough?
He's got too much to pay for.
Has she done anything to pay for?
She'd be better off without him.
Are you the judge of that? Are you the law? What makes you think you're so much better than he is? Whatever he done, he's tried to make up for it. He's lived a decent, useful life ever since. But what have you done? What are you going
to... MGM Noir directors began to form a unit. From Eagle Lion, Sherry brought in Anthony Mann. Then there was John Sturges and Russell Rouse and Andrew Stone and Fred Zinnemann, all apprenticeshipped in MGM in the B unit at this time. They were first string. Second string were people like Harold Kress and Fred Wilcox and Gerald Mayer and Leslie Cardos and David Bradley and Charles Haas. Contractees who were still there, who had done A films, were moving into the B unit, like Roy Rowland and Richard Thorpe and Tay Garnett. One or two directors from outside were hired, like Max Ophuls and Arch Obler and John Huston and Jack Berry and Joseph Lewis.
Happy, weren't you?
Sherry also started to develop photographers, particularly photographers for the B unit, particularly for the B unit that was devoted to the dark genres in the noir style. Newspaper cameraman Joseph Rutenberg began to work in this noir B style. Harry Stradling, John Alton, and Burnett Guffrey, and John Seitz. From RKO, they borrowed Nicholas Masaraka, Paul Vogel, William Meller, and of course Robert Surtees. But again, they went from A to B, black and white to A. That was what it was done. That's what production designers did too. For example, the art director was Edwin B. Willis, and he, you know, did he do anything here? He has a credit here. But also his assistant has a credit here, Hans Peters, and probably Hans Peters did the art direction for Act of Violence. The same thing with set decoration. Cedric Gibbons, you know, was the set decorator or one of them. He has a credit here, but he's assisted by Henry Grace, and probably Henry Grace did the work on Act of Violence.
Where in Santa Lisa? Okay. I'll be there.
Wake up.
Wake up. I gotta get out of here.
It's very interesting that noir MGM films began to use more and more location work. Although a lot of stuff was still shot in the studio. When they did studio work, they often used existing sets, which they redressed. Put shadows in there to make it look different, put a canted angle to make it look different, or only film part of the set. The B unit, under Sherry's guidance, also developed a string of writers like journalist Sidney Boehm and Mel Dinelli, also from RKO, John Monks Jr. from Fox, Alan Rifkin, Richard Brooks starts here, and so many stars or would-be stars or on-the-decline stars or stars who wanted a change of pace. And this is still MGM, following through with their motto, more stars than there are in their heavens. Here with Act of Violence, we have three would-be stars, Van Heflin, Robert Ryan, and Janet Leigh. But the B unit also employed stars on the decline, like Mary Astor, and sometimes stars who wanted a change of pace, like Spencer Tracy in The People Against O'Hara, a nifty noir thriller, or Doris Day in a nifty noir thriller, B film, Julie.
Only you weren't going to be there, just Johnny. He was going to be there.
Where do I find him? Where does he live?
I don't know. Nobody knows.
Well, there must be somebody.
Guys
some way
like
I can
him
find...
don't tell people where they live. Hey, where are you going?
When Fred Zinnemann came under the influence of the great documentarist Robert Flaherty, he taught him two things that stayed with him all of his life. That if you want to be an artist in movies, that was the first thing, you have to be as independent as possible from the people who control the financing of a film. In his apprenticeship period, 39 to 49 at MGM, you know, he wanted to make A films, and he went on suspension. And of course, they brought him back to do this Judy Garland, Robert Walker love story, an A film for Freed. And of course, he started to do it, and Judy didn't understand this documentary realist method. So then he was invited by a Swiss company to Europe to make a film about displaced children in Europe after the war. And here he says he will do it because there's no interference from the front office. out of this comes this movie called The Search, which got incredible reviews and it made money. Again, he did this on his own. He knew that if he was going to be an artist, if his personal concerns would emerge on the film, he would have to not listen to the money man. He would have to follow himself, much like the very central preoccupation of a Zinnemann film. I mean, you know, from his own life into his cinematic life, people have to hold on to their integrity, have to be themselves, have to reaffirm their identity if they lost it, or if it's being threatened, it'd have to hold on to it. The second thing that Robert Flaherty taught him is that you have to know how to accommodate the contributions of others while allowing them not to corrupt your own artistic integrity. And we see in Act of Violence how he allowed the contributions of others, how he accommodated the contributions of others. I mean, Surtees' photography is just a wonderful vehicle for Zinnemann's moods and his thematics. I think that what Mary Astor contributed in terms of that one dress and Zinnemann was another indication of this accommodation to the contributions of others.
Why don't I run you a nice hot bath?
Okay.
Well, come on.
Yeah. How's the baby?
Oh, fine. He was a little tired and had a runny nose, so I put him to bed early. Probably out like a light by this time.
This central preoccupation of Zinnemann, the first, the images of struggle toward self-redefinition, are mirrored in all of his work, you know. So when we take a look at this character of Joe Parkson, we see Joe Parkson imaged in people like Ken Wilczek, the Marlon Brando character in The Men, the orphan in The Search. In Teresa, it's the Phil Cass character played by John Erickson. In A Member of the Wedding, it's Frankie Adams, the character played by Julie Harris. Don Murray playing Johnny Polk mirrors this grope towards self-redefinition in the film The Hatful of Rain, as does Manuel Artiguez, the character played by Omar Sharif in Behold the Pale Horse. All of these are counterparts of Joe Parkson. And as for the image of the struggle against fragmentation that is embodied by the character of Frank Enley, well, Pat and Ida Carmody, the Deborah Carr and Robert Mitchum character in The Sundowners, Father Franciscus, the Gregory Peck character in Behold the Pale Horse, Thomas Moore in Man for All Seasons, played by Paul Scofield, the OAS group in Day of the Jackal, Julia, played by Vanessa Redgrave, and Lillian Hellman, played by Jane Fonda in Julia. The three soldiers in From Here to Eternity, Prue, played by Montgomery Clift, and Maggio, played by Frank Sinatra, and Sergeant Warden, played by Burt Lancaster, Sister Luke, sister played by Audrey Hepburn in The Nun Story, all of these are cousins of Frank Enley.
But I don't want to be your wife, because I do. The paper.
Thank you, Edith.
Let's not try to think about it anymore. Not tonight.
No.
This is the penultimate scene. It's very important because it's the last time that husband will be with wife. Again, notice the sound. Hear the sound. 8:25. Here again, a sound effects intruding upon the silence, and how insistent it is, and how loud it is. Notice also the lighting of Anne Heflin's face. Still here, it's split. one side this, one side that, because we know what he's about to do. He's about to have this guy murdered. Now, the major climax is about to take place, and it's taking place at a train station. And this major climax in this movie is a marvel of visual, compositional, editing, and sound design. Notice how, first of all, it is staged in the traditional Western finale standoff in the town's main street. And when you see the beginning of this, I want you to recall the climax of High Noon. But here it's complicated by three lines of action. This is a very interesting detail. I mean, he doesn't even pay attention to the newspaper boy who knows him because he's famous. And of course, irony. I talked about the script being full of ironies. Here, Anne, Joe's girl, and he walks right past. Again, look at the intersecting lines. I mean, she's going vertical, he's horizontal. Here is where we begin to see the staging in the traditional Western final standoff in the town's main street. And it is a dry run, really, for Zinnemann's end climax of High Noon. But here, it's complicated by three levels of action. Frank on one side of the platform, Joe on the other, and eventually there will be the thug Johnny who will ride up in a car. He will be in the middle. Remember, High Noon has only two lines of action, the sheriff and the ex-con returning to town. Notice how the sounds that we've heard earlier are repeated here, the sounds of the train whistle, the blowing wind, and the sound of Joe's dragging feet. Compositionally, the points of view are shuffled among the three men, Joe on one side, Frank on the other, and Johnny in between. Notice the cuts. They become shorter and shorter and shorter, accelerating the pace. You know, here again, another montage scene. You know, this is a climax, so he's going to build shots of short cuts. The climax also has one of the things we most love about movies from the past, and that is the scene of moral regeneration. People did end better in movies in the past than they do today, maybe because we don't believe in moral regeneration. Well, of course, we have Frank's Volfas sacrificing his life for the life of Joe, dying as a good man, his integrity preserved in spite of the fragmentation, while Joe confesses to his girl that he didn't do it. And even more than that, he will go and tell Frank's wife, Edith, of Frank's death, So his grope towards self-redefinition has been accomplished. His identity is restored. He is back to being himself again before this obsessive murderous pursuit that has locked him in to a life the last couple of years.
There's nothing you can do. Now stay back, please.
It's dangerous.
No.
I didn't do it, Ann. I didn't do it.
Call the emergency hospital. Never mind.
It's Frank Emily.
What happened? There was some kind of accident.
They were coming from the station and he was hanging on the side of the car.
Oh, hold up.
Well, I saw him drop here. Well, you were here, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to tell his wife?
I will.
And now, disarmingly, the credits roll. Credits which should have come at the beginning of the film now come at the end of the film. This is Drew Casper, thanking you for tuning in and hoping that this walkthrough, Act of Violence, was enlightening as well as fun.